Our third case for this morning is Soik against Bovis Lendlease, 11-27-47. And we will hear first from Mr. Ratzak.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me, Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Christopher Soik. This is the case in which Mr. Soik was outside working, was struck by an object in high wind, brought suit against the general contractor. District Court granted summary judgment to the general contractor. The primary issue on appeal, I think, is whether or not this Court's prior decision in Malhotra covers the circumstances of the summary judgment here. Malhotra said that if a party moves for summary judgment on ground A, he doesn't and can't expect the responding party to come in and defend on ground B, and that's what we believe happened here.
So I want to back you up into the summary judgment process in the Northern District of Illinois, because everybody's been spending a lot of time talking about the memorandum, but you filed a Rule 56.1 statement. That's part of what you have to do.
Correct.
As well.
Correct.
And in your Rule 56.1 statement, did you not indicate that there were facts showing that Mr. Soik, well, that actually Mr. Payne thought that Soik should have been working with somebody else at the time of the injury?
That's correct.
That's paragraph 39.
That's correct.
So is it your position that the district court was obliged to take the 56.1 statement into account?
The district court had before it more information than Bovis relied upon in its summary judgment motion. I'm not sure that answers your question.
Not just like the mass. Obviously, as we constantly say, district courts have no obligation to quote-unquote scour the record.
Exactly.
But by the time it's in a 56.1 statement, I want to know whether it's your view that when Bovis filed its motion for summary judgment, you were entitled, without highlighting it in your memorandum of law, which you don't seem to have done, that you were entitled to rely on the things that you had winnowed from the record and put in your 56.1 statement.
Yes, and I think more importantly, we were entitled to rely upon what the movement put into his 56.1 statement, and then when he winnowed it further, if you will, in his summary judgment argument.
Problem with that. The defendant's motion, the Bovis Lendlease motion for summary judgment, is not captioned motion for partial summary judgment.
Correct.
And indeed, the bottom line reads as though, as the district court understood it, that they were seeking summary judgment on the whole case.
Correct.
So whether they put all the things in that motion or not, I don't see why that didn't alert you to the fact the whole case was on the line.
And the answer to that is that even in their conclusion to their motion, the conclusion refers only to the eyewear issue. So we have, and I understand what you're saying, we have a situation where Bovis said we want summary judgment, but the only issue that it put before the district court in its argument at all was the eyewear issue, and the only facts that it addresses in its summary judgment motion are the facts. It didn't use the facts in its 56.1 statement. It limited those facts and cut us down.
But suppose, just for the sake of argument, it thought that was the dispositive issue. I mean, I guess I'm still having trouble understanding how it is you don't come back and say, this case isn't just about eyewear. Indeed, eyewear wasn't even one of the bullet points or whatever they were in your complaint. You had a number of other theories of negligence, and the eyewear comes in only later. Don't you need to call that to the court's attention when you see the bottom line is we're entitled to summary judgment from your opponent?
I would think that the same rule would have applied in the other cases we cited, in Witte and Sublette and Malhotra, and the courts did not make the responding party go to that extent. It would have clearly been better if we had come back in our answer to the summary judgment motion and said, by the way, Your Honor, please note that we've got X points, and they haven't looked at X points. They've only looked at Y points, which is less than X. It probably would have enlightened everyone. We did that when we came back on motion for reconsideration. If we made a mistake the first time, it wasn't as if the court said we were too late or anything else. The court just disagreed with us and said, no, you didn't bring that up the first. You didn't bring up your ground B the first time. And the cases still say that when I ask for summary judgment, and that would be what I'm asking for, to look at what I'm asking for judgment on. And you're not supposed to do it, but they asked for partial summary judgment. If you read their entire motion, in fact, their reply, if the plaintiff thought that Bovis was trying to extend itself beyond the eyewear, all the plaintiff's attorney might look at would be the reply. The reply of Bovis the reply, if it does anything, limits or more clearly that it's only looking to the eyewear issue.
Well, backing up from the injury, which is to the eye, and something that over the glasses and whatever, and we're not sure what the source of it was. It could have been caused by the wind, or somebody up above could have been splintering something, but none of that is before. So what we're looking at is the but-for, these glasses. This is where all the... it's not a pun, but focus. The glasses didn't have to focus. But to focus on the glasses because they weren't proper. And he knew it and didn't properly ask for the better glasses that apparently the employer had a variety of them. And so that's why the concentration is on that issue. These other things, maybe if it's too windy, we shouldn't have been working, or somebody shouldn't have been doing something else at the same time. We don't know where the splinter came from. That emanates pretty far out from where the guy, frankly, admits that he did not ask for better glasses. Well, he knew they weren't correct.
Your Honor's closing in on the proximate cause question, which Bovis agreed wasn't an issue below and is not an issue here. But I respectfully disagree with Your Honor in the sense that the safety of the eyewear issue is something that was only raised by our expert. Our complaint, which is where the focus should be, focuses on sending this man outside to work in 60-mile-an-hour winds where our expert testified you can't do that, and if you do that, you can't send him alone. You need somebody else out there.
The assignment that you were really – the assignment of the job up there that day that is your but-for cause, had he not been sent out, he wouldn't have been hurt.
That's correct. Or
he could have fallen off the building in those winds. He could have had something go through his eye. It could have –
Precisely. And our expert expanded. He said, and he was a rookie. He didn't really know what to do. He was He should not have been out there alone. And that was the focus that we had when we went in before the court, because that was in our complaint. We pretty much surrendered the eyewear issue because we couldn't prove that Bovis knew that Mr. Stoica had bad eyewear. And we did that in our motion. We made an argument, but at the end of the day, I would ask the court why the plaintiff in this case would think that he had to bring in more, I think the defense uses the term, more ammo to defend something that they did not attack. It may have been buried someplace in the facts, but it wasn't argued. It's not, I believe it's the Sublette case where the court said it wasn't raised in the motion, but it was clearly argued by the parties. It wasn't argued by the parties here. We don't have that way out for them. If I can just switch grounds for a moment, the alternative argument that Bovis has raised is the question of whether or not the trial court correctly ruled that Bovis entrusted the work to McHugh, who was Stoica's employer, under Section 414 of the restatement. Our response to that is set out in the brief. The question of entrustment on which they are relying is the definition used in the Turner case in Illinois, which talks about whether or not the contractor being sued had the contract with the contractor who was the employer of the injured person. And here, Bovis signed the contract. The contractors were selected with the cooperation and consultation of Bovis, and they paid them and controlled them. We would suggest here that this case is outside of Turner, if Turner is, in fact, even good law. There was no authority in Turner for the definition of entrustment that the court used in Illinois and Turner, and it stands by itself. Unless the court has further questions, that would conclude my argument.
Save rebuttal time if you like.
Thank you.
Ms. Jones.
May it please the Court, my name is Katie Jones, and I represent defendant and appellee Bovis Lendlease in this matter. The sole issue that this appeal presents is whether or not the district court erred in denying Mr. Soyka's motion for summary judgment because it was somehow misled or led astray by Bovis's motion for summary judgment.
So here's my issue with the way this was handled. First of all, the summary judgment process in the Northern District, as I was saying before, doesn't hang solely on a memo. People spend a lot of time preparing these Rule 56.1 statements of material fact and responses. And in Mr. Soyka's statement of material facts, it's very plain that there are facts presented that he should not have been, that there's actually evidence. It's not just allegations in the complaint, that there's testimony from Mr. Payne, for example, that he shouldn't have been out there by himself that day with the windy conditions. And so I'm worried when I look at the district court's, particularly the decision on reconsideration, because the district court says Soyka would have the court deny summary judgment based on the allegations in his complaint. Well, that's not really right. I mean, he's presented facts for the court. He's waded through the depositions. And he also has pointed the court to these 56.1 statements, but the court just sort of brushes them off and says, you know, they aren't important. But I think that's really not the right way to look at this whole process. There's some districts where it's all rolled together into one, but that doesn't happen to be this district.
Well, I think the response to that, Your Honor, is that in addition to the 56.1 statement, Mr. Soyka had an obligation to point out to the court how that information was relevant vis-a-vis the arguments that Bovis was presenting.
But I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm worried about how many times you have to hit the court over the head with a 2x4. Sure, you have the 56.1 statement in the memo, but shouldn't they be read together?
Of course they should be read together, but they can't. You can't just take facts and not apply them to the case in the law.
But that's where I think we come back to the Bovis memo. Bovis picks on this eyewear issue, discusses that exclusively in its motion, and then throws this generic request at the end. But under Sublett, nothing in Sublett says this is just about statutes of limitations. There's a real lack of notice, it seems to me, to the other side that more is on the table.
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses to that. First, the motion itself sets forth the relief that's being sought.
Right,
it was a motion for partial summary judgment.
No, I understand that.
It stated that there was a single count in the complaint and that they could not prove a genuine issue of material fact as to that count on the face of the motion.
Correct.
We asked for judgment. We asked for costs, a remedy that's only available upon full dismissal.
I understand. You say there's a single count, but obviously if you look at paragraph 18 of the complaint, it goes through A through H on what the negligence theories, the negligent ways, and I am a huge believer that that doesn't create different causes of action or claims or anything. It's just different ways of proving this single form of negligence. However, at the summary judgment stage, if you exclude only one and Bovis was negligent in all the other ways, Bovis still has to go to trial.
Your Honor, though, we're in a notice pleading jurisdiction, and so...
But you're beyond notice pleading by summary judgment.
And that's my point, is that we get an expert report that has all various sorts of allegations in it. It's our job, then, to try to make an argument as to what we believe the plaintiff's going to try to prove at trial.
What about the Payne deposition? Do you ignore the depositions? They highlighted in their 56.1 statement.
Sure, but there needs to be some sort of nexus. Our argument was that they cannot show that we knew that he was up there inappropriately. And Mr. Payne is not our employee. There's no nexus to that. That's their obligation to the court to show how that fact prevents the entry of summary judgment. Not all facts are relevant to all arguments.
Certainly that's right. Mr. Payne is an expert himself on this, you know, or he's a responsible person, I should say. Let's stay away from words of art. he's a responsible person on this construction site, and you would agree, I assume, as a generic matter, that there are some days that are just too dangerous to be working way up there.
And, you know, while this is, I don't know if it's in the record here, but, you know, Bovis did have a policy that they wouldn't work on a certain wind speed. Plaintiff's own meteorologist puts the wind speed below that level.
On the ground, yeah.
No, on the level of the floor on which he was working on that day. That was his best estimate.
What was Bovis's, does the record show what Bovis's threshold was?
I don't know if it's a record before the court, but the record underneath would definitely indicate that it was 25 miles per hour.
I thought he thought it was 65.
That was plaintiff's testimony. And what's interesting about that is that testimony is not in plaintiff's 56.1 statement. And if it was, we would have moved to strike it as being inadmissible because plaintiff's not qualified to give the wind speed. Plaintiff hired a meteorologist in this case to give expert testimony, and their meteorologist put the wind speed at 22 miles an hour. So that's one of the problems. I mean, it highlights one of the problems with this motion is that in the brief, we're just pulling out random facts from the deposition that weren't highlighted in the 56.1 statement, that weren't argued in the memorandum. And
no, I agree with you. If it's not in the 56.1 statement, I'm not interested in either. So that's, you know, I think we agree.
And I would also point out to the court that it's not as if Bovis was hiding the ball. If you look at our memorandum, the word wind conditions or weather conditions is mentioned 10 times in our memorandum. So it's not as if we're out there arguing apples and the plaintiff comes back with oranges. The issues are all interconnected. And so they had an obligation to respond. I mean, simply put, we argued explicitly in our brief that they could not prove we breached any duty to them with respect to their negligence claim. They failed to put forth or highlight any facts to the court that would support that argument. They didn't address it in the brief. We then filed a reply memorandum explicitly arguing that that argument had been waived because they failed to respond. At that point in time, they could have moved to file a surreply, which they didn't do. They could have made some other effort to make their position known to the court, which they didn't do, but instead they waited until summary judgment was granted. And then at that point, they came in and said, hey, you need to reconsider this. I didn't know. I didn't know what the scope of the motion was. And I think that's a difficult argument to make, because when you look at the pleadings, it's very, very clear what the scope of the motion was in the first instance. And that's central to the summary judgment process.
That clear. I mean, the motion is internally inconsistent, but I would agree with you if you look at the bottom line of the motion, it certainly looks to me like it's a general motion for summary judgment, not a partial.
And I would submit that if the rule of law that plaintiff is advocating was put into place, you'd end up with a series of endless summary judgment motions. I mean, essentially, a defendant would be put in a position of filing a summary judgment motion based on what they believed the plaintiff was going to try to prove at trial. That could be completely ignored in the briefing and in the 56.1 statement. Summary judgment could be entered. They could come back with another theory. You could go through the whole process a second time, and they could come back with a third theory.
Well, it's a question of burden, and I will say that under Celotex, it's very easy to put in a statement saying, we don't think that the plaintiff is going to be able to meet its burden of proof on theories 1 through 5. That's all you have to do. The burden on a person who does not bear the burden of proof on a particular point is quite light under Celotex. There was a huge amount of literature at the time Celotex was decided about that. Some people thought that was a good idea, others didn't, but that's what it is. So I don't think that the burden on a moving party saying, we don't have the burden of proof, we say we're entitled to summary judgment, we're going to talk about this thing that was in the experts' reports, but we don't think the plaintiff can meet his burden on anything else, is a very big burden at all. And if you file something that makes it look like you're really just focusing on something, especially under the new version of 56, partial summary judgment is even more prominent than under the old version. I'm not sure that this horrible prospect of thousands of motions for summary judgment would happen at all. People would just have a paragraph saying, we don't think you can prove anything else. And then the plaintiff would be alerted to the fact, well, now's the time. You know, come in and show which theory you can support.
Sure, and that's exactly what the plaintiff should have done in this case, but didn't do.
Without, though, you alerting the plaintiff, but in the context of a brief that made it look like you were really indeed focusing only on the eyeglasses.
The eyeglasses, though, they're always tied to the weather conditions. The argument is that the eyeglasses were inappropriate for the weather conditions. Everything has to be taken together because there's a certain set of facts that create, arguably, an injury.
Maybe. I mean, I can imagine even with perfect eyeglasses, the wind could be so bad that a person couldn't maintain his hold on the side of the building and he'd blow off, you know. So that doesn't seem like eyeglasses are going to help you much when you hit the ground.
Arguably, but then the plaintiff has the burden of putting that evidence before the court, and the burden simply wasn't met in this case. I'd like to focus for 2 minutes, if I may, on the entrustment issue. Is an alternative ground for the basis that the ruling below should be affirmed. We submit that the recent case by the Illinois Appellate Court of O'Connell versus Turner Construction would also warrant entry of summary judgment on Bovis's behalf in this case. What O'Connell says is that if you have a claim under the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 414, that a prerequisite to liability under that section is that you need to entrust work to an independent contractor. And in this case, what O'Connell says is that you need to actually contract or select the independent contractor for there to be that prerequisite of entrustment. And O'Connell goes on to say, merely helping an owner with a bidding process, helping an owner vet subcontractors, even you know, signing as an agent isn't enough for that entrustment to exist. And we would submit that the facts on this case are identical to that of the O'Connell versus Turner case as an alternate ground that the district court's opinion should be affirmed.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Rathsack?
If the court pleases. The problem on their part, I believe, is that their motion did not show or did not even argue there was a factual issue about whether or not Mr. Soika should have been sent outside. Our 56.1.
Why was that their burden to say that, though, since you had the burden of proof on that point?
Because they have at some point to create an issue of fact. They have to show there is no issue of fact on something that we've alleged in the complaint, and they don't do that.
Why can't they just implicitly or explicitly say we don't think there are any issues of fact, and then it's up to you with the burden of proof? It's not like it was an affirmative defense where they had the burden of proof. There, surely they had, would have had, you know, some obligation to take the lead.
I would respectfully disagree with the court if all they had to do was simply say we don't think you can prove your case. I believe that there has to be a little bit more than that, and here they didn't say that you can't prove there was no wind. They didn't say you can't prove that you shouldn't have been sent outside. We didn't say that we didn't control the people that were sending you outside. Any one of those things might have put them within Celotex, but they didn't go there. And then when we came back and said in our response, you're only looking at the eyewear, and that's pretty clear from looking at our answer, I think, is that we've only said we're looking at the eyewear. And we have a 56.1 response in their reply. If there was any doubt about where they were going, the reply clarified that they agreed it was just raising two contentions, the eyewear, control of the eyewear and notice of the eyewear. That's all its reply said. So up until that point, the plaintiff now was assured there was nothing at issue except the eyewear. And the district court took it one step further, unfortunately. And when we came back to the district court in our defense, we gave the district court a second chance, and it said no. I disagree with that, obviously. We were not late, and there was a reason. I think the court can see there was at least a reason for the plaintiff in this case to assume that the only thing they had to address before this court was, in fact, the question of whether or not Bovis controlled our eyewear or McHugh's eyewear. Unless the court has further questions, obviously our remedy is to ask for reversal and remand. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.